Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Australia is back on track.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
Just dumbstruck.
I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
I don't think I know.
I have no hesitation.
That should cause great concern.
Just sit down, Griffiths.
It's sick of your lies.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant.
He needs a mirror.
I mean...
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
G'day, Mark Kenny here with another Democracy Sausage, which of course comes to you from the Australian National University, specifically the Australian Studies Institute, the School of Politics and International Relations, and the excellent Crawford School of Public Policy. This week we thought we might get a little bit out of the step away from the daily sushi train of events and look at some of the bigger, deeper trends, things that are shaping our politics and our society. With me today, as usual, is Dr. Maria Teflaga, political scientist. Welcome, Maria.
Hello, Mark. Hello, everyone.
And also joining us this time from the University of Western Sydney, Sukhmani Khurana. She's a VC's senior fellow at the Young and Resilient Research Centre at the Western Sydney University. Welcome, Sukhmani.
Thank you, Mark. Very happy to be here.
And Fan Young. Fan Young is a PhD candidate at Deakin University, where she researches WeChat during elections and migrant voices. She's also an analyst at Freedom House. Welcome, Fan.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me here.
It's a great pleasure to have you all. And it's appropriate that we should have names such as yours, including Maria's, which are all names that perhaps don't fit into, unlike mine, that don't fit into that sort of Anglo-Celtic, Irish kind of standard phenotype that we've seen dominating power and business and everything else in Australian society, because everything's changing. And in fact, we always talk about ourselves as a multicultural nation. Malcolm Turnbull, for example, used to say Australia is the most successful multicultural nation in the world. And I guess in some ways that might be right. In other ways, I think it's open to challenge. It's not a sort of a uniform picture across all indices. But Sukhmani, perhaps I'll start with you. We just had a census release. What did we learn about the makeup of Australian society now from that census?
So I think everyone's been a little bit surprised by what they've learned from the census. Of course, we knew from the 2016 census that, you know, the makeup of the Australian population is changing. And what I mean by that is that, as you just said, that we have more people from non-Anglo-Celtic backgrounds in Australia now. But what we didn't expect was that almost half of the Australian population now has one parent or both parents born overseas. In addition to that, countries like India and China are now in the top three after England in terms of people from those countries of origins calling Australia home. We've also had big increases from countries like Nepal, from countries like Vietnam, and refugee populations increasing in certain parts of Sydney and Melbourne. So I think the reason people have been surprised is because when you look at our institutions, when you look at, you know, who's in the decision-making roles in institutions like politics, in the media, in corporate Australia, you don't see that demographic makeup reflected in those places, which are kind of symbolic of what Australian democracy is or what Australia as a nation is. So I think we have a lot to learn from the census and what it means, not just for our future and our planning needs and what our ancestries will look like in decades to come, but also how we need to make some concerted efforts to change the makeup of our institutions.
Yes, I want to come back to that question about the institutions in a moment, but just if I could get you to expand for a moment on a point you made right at the end there about ancestries, the changing nature of the backgrounds, I suppose, of the people in Australia. What can you just explain that point a bit further?
So in this particular census, our ancestries having the top five ancestry is the same as the 2016 census, which from memory is, I think, English, Irish, Scottish, Chinese. But given that the countries of origin have shifted significantly, the countries of origin is different from ancestry. The countries of origin is when, you know, you have when you have first and second generation migrants, whereas if you are talking about ancestry, your ancestors have been in Australia longer, and therefore, you know, the data looks different.
I see.
But
right.
Given that the countries of origin have shifted significantly, what it also means is that, say, in a generation or so, or in about half a generation, the ancestry will also begin to change. And that is significant because it means that who we think of as Australian settlers or people who think of themselves as Australian, which in the minds of most people used to be Anglo-Celtic, is becoming slightly more, Southern European because of the population, the migration populations that we had the Second World War. That idea has shifted a little bit. We have, people from Southern Europe and Eastern Europe also tend to passes white or passes Australian much more than people who are Asian Australian or African Australian, for instance. So that's already shifting. But I think with the changes in the top five countries of birth and countries of origin, the ancestry data will also begin to change in a decade or more. And that's certainly of significance to how we imagine Australia and how, you know, other countries will imagine Australia in the future.
Now, Maria, I want to come to you in a moment and ask you about a point about the Sukumani just made before about the institutions, our institutions being very British. But before I do that, just one last detailed question to you, Sukumani, about you made the point about the half of the population being having a parent or both parents who was born overseas, or they were born over the seas themselves. I think it's significantly more than half there, if you put all those things together. And a quarter of Australians speak a language other than English at home, which is, you know, that's amazing when you actually think about it.
Yes, I think I was surprised by that as well, because the assumption often is that if people are here and they're Australia has a large section of the population that come as skilled migrants, which means that, you know, whether you're coming from India or China or another country where English might not be the first language, you have to pass a test. So the assumption is that you have a passable level of English. But the reality is that obviously people are going to make an effort to continue to hang on to their culture of origin, and so they should. Including their mother tongue. So even when you have second generation Australians, there's an upsurge in parents and grandparents trying to teach that language to their children. And so, you know, there is the practice of continuing with the tradition of being bilingual, even in households which have been in Australia for a while. You can see that reflected in the data, in addition to obviously first generation migrants continuing to speak their mother tongue in their households, in addition to using English outside of the household.
Now, Maria, I imagine you're actually one of those people who comes from who grew up in a household where English wasn't spoken in the household as well as as well as it being spoken in the household. So perhaps you're a good person to turn to, both to talk about that question I flagged a minute ago, or that issue, and also the question I flagged a minute ago, the nature of our institutions, which are, you know, very, very British in their design and history. Can they continue on? Do they need to change?
That's a really good question about institutions. I mean, I'm not convinced that their Britishness is necessarily an issue. Mm. That doesn't mean that, you know, we couldn't think about ways to make them more like open and democratic. Like, I don't think, another way of saying this is, I don't think the Westminster system is inconsistent with, you know, achieving good representational outcomes. And, you know, we could just look at, for example, proportional representation systems, which do a much better job of having a broader variety of candidates actually get elected, or just simply multi-member districts. They do a better job of getting more voters up. And you can kind of sort of see this in terms of the Senate generally produces better minority representation at the federal level. But, you know, the other half of this story is, of course, political parties, you know, who are key gatekeepers in terms of, you know, all the selection processes that happen beforehand. And I don't just mean pre-selection, you know, of course, you know, one has to pay one's dues in a political party. And migrants have actually, like, since the 60s really, been quite active within political parties and have enjoyed varying levels of success depending on the tier of government. Obviously, it's easier to get elected at local government, and so, you know, migrant groups have performed better at this stage. And I guess it sort of goes to the question, right, is, you know, a debate, I guess, I suppose, which boils down to everything will be okay. We just have to wait for, you know, the system to slowly respond as, you know, migrants' children grow up and basically enter politics, which seems to be the typical pattern, mostly because migrants are busy kind of working out how to live here and, like, get on with stuff, and participating in politics is, you know, a bridge too far.
That's true. But I mean, as I've pointed out on this pod before, we do have, if you think about our leaders at the moment, just think about these names: Palaszczuk, Albanese, Malinauskas, Perrottet. These are not Anglo-Celtic names. So, and they're the leaders, you know, they're the prime minister and the premiers of the biggest states and so forth.
So that's good evidence for the "it'll be fine, just wait" argument.
Well, it's, but, you know, it is some evidence for that, true. But it's also evidence that, I mean, I was really thinking about it in terms of your argument about, you know, migrants have been active in our political parties and have had some success. And, you know, when Perrottet replaced Berejiklian, for example, there have been quite a few more recently. There's an acceleration of this, I think, is what I'm saying. I'm not trying to make an argument that it's all sorted. Don't get me wrong.
No. I know you're not trying to. I know you're not trying to say that. You know. So I think, you know, it's quite likely that migrants and people who are non-white or white passing would face additional and specific barriers to entering politics, just like, you know, women, for example, face barriers into politics, and then that would, you know, intersect with, you know, typical kinds of things like class and race, right, to do with the ability to accumulate resources in order to run for office or to be able to dedicate yourself to the specific kind of career that makes you attractive to political parties, and then just to simply, like, you know, ideas that exist within parties about what makes a good candidate or what a successful candidate can possibly look like. And I think the last election we just had is a really interesting, I guess, shake-up of the idea of what a good candidate can look like, because I think since 96, and I promise to stop talking after this, since 1996, which is when the proportion of migrants in the Australian Parliament kind of bumped up to 20%, it has effectively sat at that level. And it's reflected the waves of migration. So in 96, it was the Dutch and, you know, Germans and things like that. And, you know, slowly we're sort of seeing more Southern Europeans who were the group that came in a little bit later. And now we're starting to see waves of migration that came after that. So, you know, I guess the picture is mixed. Like, could we do more? Absolutely. You know, is the system responding? Actually, yeah, I'm quite pleased.
Fan Young, the point Maria makes about the political system being geared in a certain way, having certain biases or proclivities built into it, is right, of course. And we just have to look at our parliament to see that. But migrant communities have indeed been active, and they've been sort of active. I wonder what you think about this proposition, that they've been active in ways that have been useful to the people who've held the levers of power. So within both the Labor Party and the Liberal Party, it's been quite common to hear of, you know, a Greek branch or the Lebanese community that's sort of leveraged for the control of a certain number of votes in pre-selections and so forth. Sometimes members of these communities have benefited from these processes, but it's very much been a sort of a case of kind of shoehorning those cultures into our political machinery, largely for the purposes of the furtherance of people within that machinery. Is that changing, or do you agree with that proposition, and can it change?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Thanks, Mark. And before I respond to this question, I think I do want to respond to some points raised by Sukhmani and also Maria in terms of multiculturalism, because this topic, multiculturalism, has been extensively discussed in our symposium, Migrants' Voices in Australia Politics, held by Deakin early this month. So multiculturalism as a national policy keeps evolving. And if we look at multicultural policies across Australian states, for example, Victoria, New South Wales, Western Australia, etc., you can see that different states, they have different frameworks, or they have different kinds of framings about multiculturalism. And their framings of multiculturalism, or the involvement of multiculturalism, is contingent on how Australia as a nation state wants to engage with its migrant communities. So multiculturalism ideally should be an inclusive ideological discourse promoting multicultural equity instead of consolidating the hegemonic culture or Australian exceptionalism. But on the other hand, we do see the idea of, for example, mainstream Australia and Australian national unity, national interest promoted by some politicians in Australia. So it seems like diversity or multiculturalism at the working level is lacking. And this comes back to your previous question in terms of the diverse representation of Australian politicians in the parliament. So it's really nice, or it's really, you know, it's really nice to see that we now have more and more politicians coming from ethnic migrant communities and also Indigenous backgrounds. But also the thing that, from my research, me and Dr. Robert Fordyce at Monash University and Dr. Luke Hinsbergen at Deakin University, we look into Australian federal election among Chinese migrants and what kind of information and public opinions have been mobilized among the Chinese diaspora on WeChat. So we have identified that the expectation from Chinese migrant communities about the politicians coming from migrant backgrounds, it is no longer that they need more politicians of Chinese cultural heritage to represent their community, but to what extent these politicians would be able to voice out on behalf of the communities. So one example that I could show the audience is that during the pre-election, Chinese migrants concerned whether candidates of Chinese cultural heritage can represent the voices of Chinese communities. And this has been manifested in Chinese migrants' disappointment towards Gladys Liu for not representing the community's voices or standing up against racism.
Can I just stop you there for a moment? Because that's a really sure. interesting point. Gladys Lau was the candidate, the member for Chisholm. Correct?
Yes.
Yes. And
yes.
In a seat often generally thought to be a Labor seat, but one that she wrested off Labor in a by-election a couple of cycles ago, and she was defeated at this most recent election. And you were saying there that the Chinese, very strong Chinese population in that electorate, which her candidacy was thought to be, you know, this great masterstroke in getting her, and certainly it worked in the sense that she took that seat from the Labor Party in that by-election that had been held by the former Speaker. So there was a lot of support for it for her. But are you saying the Chinese community there became disillusioned because as the Liberal government ramped up its anti-China rhetoric, we had Dutton talking about the drums of war and a whole lot of other sort of lots of statements being made by various people, including the Prime Minister, that the Chinese community felt that it was – that Gladys Lau was not not standing up for the Chinese community, yep. but was siding with the Liberal Party, with the Liberal government against her own people. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, indeed. So actually, I can explain it better by raising one example. Mm-hmm. So within the Liberal Party, there are diverted attitudes towards whether to use WeChat and how to use WeChat as a platform to mobilize their political campaign. And this kind of discussion has been repetitively hyped, especially in January 2022, when the news of Scott Morrison's missing WeChat account broke. Scott Morrison, James Patterson, and Gladys Lau, they publicly expressed to Australian media that we're going to boycott WeChat. We're not going to use WeChat anymore. So in February 2022, at Chinese media online briefing, both Alex Hawke and Scott Morrison expressed their willingness to communicate with Chinese migrants on WeChat, but there was no substantial actions observed in our research. On the other end, within the Liberal Party, we have seen, for example, Gladys Lau. She kind of adopted a differentiated approach towards WeChat, and this mirrored her position in the parliament and the power dynamic in Australian politics. So Gladys Lau has been facing a dilemma, which is the marginalized position as an Asian female in Australian parliament who didn't have too much power at that time. And she's losing trust from Chinese migrants. And because of her silence towards racism during the pandemic and not being able to voice for the Chinese diaspora, and she tends to position herself as a close ally, showing strong solidarity to Scott Morrison. And during the pre-election, she actually mobilized her supporters or followers on WeChat, and she wanted her followers on WeChat to relocates their communication or conversation or political campaign away from WeChat to WhatsApp. And immediately there was a backlash from Chinese migrant community because they thought, we have been using WeChat for a very long time and why we should use WhatsApp because of you. So gradually she started losing trust from the community.
That's really interesting,
That's
isn't it, Maria? Yeah.
That was absolutely fascinating. And I think what you highlight a lot of really important points, Fan, there, right? Like the first one being that, you know, the practice of multiculturalism in Australia is generally pretty thin, right? It's sort of like food and festivals and dancing, which are all non-threatening to the core business of, you know, how the Australian state runs and what norms sort of follow, which kind of circle back to our original question, right, about whether or not Westminster can do a good job or the British origins of our sort of political system. But I think what you're saying there, Fan, about the community's sort of loss of trust in Gladys Lou, because essentially she failed to stand up for them. You know, that's like a story that has been echoed across the electorate, right? In terms of a sort of fundamental failure to undertake core representative functions, particularly when that community was under so much pressure during the first waves of the pandemic because of all the sort of racist attacks that were happening on Chinese people. Do you know if people sort of confronted her with that on the platform, or was it sort of a sort of more low-level grievance?
Well, I think there is a variety kind of engagement of Australian politicians in terms of how they, you know, how they communicate with Chinese migrants on WeChat. And Gladys Liu was quite active on WeChat with regard to her personal WeChat account, because I added her personal account because I wanted to see how she mobilized her own political campaign since 2019. So I have been working on monitoring Australian federal elections since 2019. And she was quite active in terms of her engagement with Chinese migrant communities. But this kind of engagement was majorly about she was making posts about how she talked to those vendors or business owners in Box Hill, which is a suburb with high density of residents coming from East Asian backgrounds. And this kind of communication was pretty much one way. So instead of using her personal WeChat post to actually have two-way effective communication with her followers or contacts, from what I could tell, she basically just used her WeChat personal account as a kind of mass media channel to broadcast what she has done to the community without having too much engagement or communication with the community.
It's really interesting, actually, because that's sort of like a microcosm of what we've been talking about, what was implicit in my question, and that is that notion that sort of multicultural or cultural minority communities that get a representative in our political system are essentially conforming to our political system. And here we had Gladys Liu actually, in the judgment of her constituents, essentially joining the political class and behaving as a member of that dominant political class rather than engaging and representing her own community from whence she came, and which was largely the reason why she was pre-selected in the first place. And that sort of tells a story about the resilience of our political system to sort of try and hold its form against these new social realities that we have in this multicultural country. And, of course, the other big thing that Gladys Liu did wrong was side with Scott Morrison, and we saw what happened to Josh Frydenberg and a number of others who decided to stand with Scott Morrison. They went over a cliff, as did she. Let's take a quick break there and come back and continue this excellent discussion.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. We were discussing about the sort of interplay between these multicultural changes in Australia and politics. What did we learn, do you think? Perhaps I'll come to you, Sukhmani, on this. What did we learn through the pandemic about Australian identity and Australian citizenship? Because there were some, you know, we all saw it. There were some really easy thing or big things, but they were done easily in the pandemic, which were quite dramatic and yet caused no sort of political disquiet here. We essentially stopped immigration straight away. We closed our borders. We even told Australian citizens who were abroad, you can't come home. And there was almost no backlash about it. We had the Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister, you know, just simply saying we want to have an international inquiry into the origins of the virus in Wuhan, you know, without any sort of consultation or any deftness in the approach. All of these things to me spoke to a sort of a background level of Australian identity, of its sense of itself, which wasn't actually as far removed from the Australia of the White Australia policy leading up to the 1970s as we might think we have come.
Thank you, Mark. That's a great question. But before I get to COVID and how we behaved as a nation and the kinds of trust we had in government, I just want to respond to a couple of points that Fan raised. I think those are really fascinating insights about how the Chinese community felt in the way that they were represented by Gladys Liu and what happened in the last election. I think what we also need to think about is kind of comparing ourselves with similar style Western democracies. If you look at research that has happened in countries like the UK or Canada, which have similarly large multicultural populations, what we see is that politicians from ethnic minority backgrounds, especially those who are non-white and successful, are often successful because they're able to appeal to both sides. They're able to represent and harness the interests and appeal of their ethnic community. And they're also kind of able to appeal to what you might call the mainstream. And I think the reason that Gladys Liu, I guess, kind of faltered, there were a number of reasons, was because she went for one over the other in terms of kind of supporting Scott Morrison. And that was also quite disastrous in this case because of the way Scott Morrison and the coalition government treated Chinese Australians during the COVID outbreak. So there is no such thing as a voting bloc when you think about ethnic groups. That's what research says, unless a particular community is slighted by a party or a government that's in power. Yes. And that's what we saw play out in the case of the Chinese Australian community. So I had a number of mainstream media outlets for the first time come to me and many other researchers to ask how the Indian Australian community was going to vote. And many of us said, look, there isn't going to be one decisive kind of Indian Australian vote because they haven't been affected in the same way that the Chinese Australians have been affected by the way that the government has been kind of, you know, scapegoating them.
There was that moment, Sukhmani, where the government for a time had was threatening to jail Indian Australians to come home.
Yeah.
That wouldn't have been a particularly well-received moment.
I mean, if there was a federal election a week after that happened, I would say it would have had an impact. But I think there was some degree of amnesia, and the Scott Morrison government tried very hard to appease a lot of first-generation Indian Australians through the diplomatic relationships they tried to cultivate with Modi. So they tried to kind of sweep all of that under the carpet, which was only about a year ago. But I think we were also asked the question of whether that travel ban would impact the Indian Australian vote. And many surveys, which were undertaken by diasporic media at the time, revealed that it would affect the vote for a section of the population, but not for everyone, which also speaks to, you know, migrant communities and how the levels of trust that they have in government. So there's a Scanlon Foundation survey that told us that, you know, people who are from a non-English speaking backgrounds have a very low levels of community or political engagement other than casting a vote in the election. Of course, you know, it doesn't examine phenomena like WeChat that Fan has, which I think is also very important to kind of tap into, and not just your regular indicators of what constitutes political or community action. But that aside, I think the broader point I'm trying to make is that they have low levels of political action and community engagement, but they have high levels of trust in the government, especially in the first 5 years of them being here. So what we saw with a number of these communities who were of migrant background and recently arrived is that they trusted the government to do the right thing and to shut the borders, and there wasn't a big backlash. But we also saw that there was Australian politics became hyper-local. We thought that would happen in the wake of the pandemic, but the election results certainly, speak to that particular outcome. And again, you know, you have varying, that has particular implications for migrant communities. But again, it's important to separate the working class migrants from other kinds of migrants, which who might be in suburbs that have higher kind of median incomes and better schools, for example. Go on, Maria.
Oh, sorry, because I think that's exactly what you're saying right now relates to the answer to why there is not necessarily an ethnic voting bloc and why it's actually a really insulting question, right? Because it sort of assumes or essentializes migrant groups around one issue domain or one strand of their personhood, right? And sort of ignores the fact that they have differing levels of education, different types of jobs, and obviously different kinds of interests, right, that are not just centered around either their migrant status or their specific ethnic status. One of the reasons why historically we might sort of say that groups of voters voted in a bloc wasn't necessarily because they were, you know, quote unquote, from an ethnic background, it's because they were working class.
Yeah, so they were Irish, or they were the first wave of Chinese immigrants, or they were the Irish immigrants, or whatever.
Right,
and they were essentially working class, economically disadvantaged. Yes, quite right.
Yeah. So anyway, please, I interrupted your flow. I'm sorry.
No, I think that's a very important point. And I think that class, alongside generation of migration, I think class is a really important factor when you're talking about migrant communities, because the census really brought that to light. I mean, I think we were all talking about how particular areas of Western Sydney had harsher lockdowns. They had more essential workers. They suffered more. Same thing with suburbs in Melbourne, like, you know, whether we had the towers, which were under lockdown in North Melbourne and Flemington, and the way that they were treated. But that's also bringing up concerns like, who did they trust then? Who did they trust people from within their own communities, regardless of which political party they belonged to? Did they increase their level of engagement with local politics? What about issues of political literacy? Some of us also tried to engage with these communities through various forums in the lead up to the election to try and understand what their issues were. And to have a bit of an intervention, which wasn't along the lines of vote for this party, but if these are the issues that matter to you, this is what the major parties are doing about it. And I think if community leaders, this is ethnic community leaders, as well as leaders from the mainstream political parties, want to have meaningful engagement with ethnic communities, they need to be able to obviously understand that they're not going to vote just on the basis of their ethnicity, but also actually engage with them on that kind of nuanced level, instead of just visiting a community center or a temple or posting a curry selfie. That needs to be more than kind of symbolic in nature.
Yeah, absolutely. It strikes me as really interesting. I may have made this point before too, but we noticed when there was 10 candidates for the Tory leadership in Britain, that half of those 10 were women, and more than half of them were from non-Anglo-Celtic backgrounds. And that's for the Tory party. That's for the British Conservative Party. It feels like, I think, Fan, you made the point that, non-English speaking background politicians have chosen one side or the other to represent, whereas the successful politicians may not have been, it may have been Sukmani. But anyway, the successful politicians are capable of synthesizing a number of interests and communicating with both. I wonder whether that's what those politicians in the UK are doing that politicians in Australia have proven unable to do, and our political system has been more sort of resiliently, has resisted that kind of behaviour.
So I think one way for me, I have been trying to argue this point, and I think one way to kind of sum it up is to think about not just consider migrant communities as a separate part of Australian society, but actually, in fact, migrant communities, they are dependent on Australian hegemonic society in order to be heard, in order to be represented. So I would like to raise 3 points, and I will start with 2 anecdotes. So at the symposium, Migrants' Voices in Australian Politics, we have one panel of speakers who told us that she picked up Australian accent very quickly within 3 years during the pandemic, because Australian accent for her is a shield for her, it's a protection for her so that she won't be discriminated in Australia. And she has experienced quite bad, brutal racist attack, verbal attack in public. And another anecdote was during the pandemic, in light of the onset racial attack against Asian communities in Australia, I was told by my mom that not to speak Mandarin in public, only to speak English in public so that people wouldn't consider me as a Chinese, so that people wouldn't attack me in public. So that points to the idea of racism during the pandemic. And the second point I'd like to point out is during the pandemic, I have done a research with Chinese migrant media professionals, and I wanted to understand how the tension between Australia and China has been translated in their news articles. And I was told by a couple of Australian migrant media professionals that back in good times when China and Australia enjoyed quite friendly relationship, it was okay for them to side with either side. They could report news stories on behalf of China, and they could report news stories on behalf of Australian businesses. But during the pandemic, because of the increasingly intensified tension between China and Australia, they had to pick a side. And then they chose to side with Australia so that their business can survive. And siding with Australia or being part of the mainstream society, it's part of the survival technique of migrant communities. So if we look at the bigger picture, and if we take it back to think about the history of multiculturalism in Australia, since the 1970s, Australia rebranded itself with the official proposal of multiculturalism, to erase the country from the colonial past and serve the neoliberal economic end. And I think colonial past is very important to point out. So from the 1970s to 1980s, the meaning of Australian multiculturalism has been transformed from cultural pluralism to cultural assimilation, with the latter one prioritizing Australian identity and unity. In a mindset of migrants, to be part of Australia means to be part of the mainstream white society, which has been paradoxically designed to exclude non-white migrants through their daily engagement with public institutions, social norms, commercial entities, and aesthetics. So I think those are the 3 points that I'd like to respond to your question, Mark.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Now, we're getting very close to time, and I want to put a question that I'll try and get all of you to address yourselves to, perhaps quite briefly because we are close to time. I'll start with you, Maria. I wonder, do you think there is a tension between progressive politics and multiculturalism has always been a very strongly supported by the progressive side of politics. Do you think there is inevitably a sort of a tension that arises between progressive politics pushing multiculturalism as an idea and being very inclusive and so forth, and the way in which some of those communities that are encouraged to be strengthened and proud about their identities and so forth, the way they then can be deployed in the political process? They might be deployed for their religious convictions in relation to socially progressive policy like same-sex marriage and dying with dignity, these sorts of issues that might come up, abortion even. So I wonder, you know, is there a tension there? And this, I suppose, goes, Maria, to the a little bit to the question about, you know, it touches off on that question about our institutions, our political culture. If we have just a sort of a simple binary, then it's one thing, but it's a much more complicated picture. I mean, perhaps that was why the Prime Minister was so keen to promote Catherine Deaves in Warringah, because she was sort of dog whistling to these faith communities, not just English speaking faith communities, but some others as well that might be electorally important for him.
Okay, that's a really complicated question, and so because I know we need to wrap up, I will give a relatively truncated answer, and I'll just sort of speak to one bit of that. I don't think for the main political parties engage with migrant groups out of the goodness of their hearts. I think they engage with migrant groups for the same reason they engage with religious groups, or sporting groups, because they are organized groups of people and it's efficient to engage with groups on this level.
Mm.
And I think that on average, you know, depending on the interest of that individual MP, it will probably shape the shallowness or the richness and the meaningfulness of that interaction with that group, you know, like I wouldn't say that migrant groups lack agency in this. I mean, there are parts of our major cities that, you know, migrant groups or religious groups effectively kind of control the sort of branches of those areas. And it's not necessarily that they're, you know, that they're doing that out of the goodness of their hearts either, or, you know, because they want to see their communities promoted. I mean, you know, in some cases that would be the case. And in some cases, these are just people who are interested in accruing power, like, you know, cynical politicians from non-migrant groups are. So I think it's a complex kind of picture. Our institutions exist. They are sets of structures, rules, and norms, and individuals come to them and effectively see what they can get out of them. And for some people, it's a lot easier for them to extract whatever they need out of this institution or to push themselves forward into that institution, or they can bring, you know, the numbers that they can then from their community, that which they can translate into power, right? We see this with branch stacking of all kinds, from all kinds of faith groups or religious groups or sporting groups, or you know what I mean? Like, it's not just, I mean, Malcolm Turnbull pretty much engaged in branch stacking. He kind of admits that, like, he drew on his networks within that community. But I guess it is important for our political system to maintain its legitimacy to be able to meaningfully reflect where society is at without too great a lag. But just quickly, Maria,
is secular progressivism as sort of a tradition on the Australian left harder when you have large faith communities who are more conservative on these social questions?
Well, it can be, but I think it really depends what the issues of the day are. I mean, like, you know, I know Scott Morrison and co sort of thought that they were hitting on a real winner with the Catherine Deaves and the trans issues. But I mean, I think the Sydney Morning Herald went and actually spoke with the leaders of those faith communities. So, you know, arguably people who are most likely to be paying attention to what is kind of going on at a high level of politics, because they occupy a representative function for their communities, and they hadn't even heard of the issue, let alone Catherine Deaves. So I think that's my point. Parties make these assumptions about migrant groups as being X or Y, failing to understand that they're actually made up of kind of, you know, broad communities. And, yeah, like, sure, issues like trans rights might be deeply disturbing to certain migrant groups or certain religious groups because they're simply unfamiliar or whatever, right? But, like, it kind of, to go back to the point we said before, like, it's a hierarchy of issues, and, you know, I would be prepared to bet that migrant groups face all the same cost of living pressures that the average Anglo ancestry Australian does, and then a few extra complicated ones because of their responsibilities that they might have, you know. So parties sort of always talk about being able to recruit, right, these groups that they're readily available, but they treat them like one-dimensional people. And so, it's not surprising then that they're actually more likely to be motivated or mobilized because they've been systematically insulted or just on the sort of classic material grounds or post-material grounds that most voters are mobilized on.
Yeah. Sukhmani?
I think to your point, Maria, of, you know, what mobilizes migrant voters, that's really important to understand that it is what mobilizes the rest of the population in addition to what else might be affecting them because of their ethnicity amongst the various other dimensions of who they are as individuals and collectivities. To give you a very quick example, I was constantly trying to bring up infrastructure issues in the outer suburban areas of Melbourne and Sydney, where most new migrants live, you know, to the attention of the media as issues that they should highlight in addition to, you know, funding for temples and community centers. But it rarely made it to the top of their list. And secondly, I think it is assumed with the success of the Teal Independence and the Green Wave that climate change is an issue which is concerning, you know, the wealthier electorates. But if you look at, you know, the purchase of electric vehicles or the demand for electric vehicles, it's much higher in parts of Western Sydney than it is in certain parts of the northern beaches or the eastern suburbs. So if you really started to drill down into, you know, what affects migrant voters, I think the picture or the perceptions that political parties have and then the media class then picks up is different from what is taking place on the ground. So I would also bet that, you know, issues of faith or social conservatism are not as big a part of the picture as they're made out to be.
Yeah, really interesting. And finally to you, Fan.
Thanks. So I think the final mark that I'd like to make is that firstly, different organizations, including universities, academic researchers, political think tanks, and also Australian media, we engage with migrant voices in Australian politics quite differently. But one thing that at Kernel is that to what extent Australian lens is represented in the research. And diversity has been instrumentally used by Australian politicians and also public institutions as something representative. And the voices of migrants are not well accepted. And finally, I think nuances and complexities within the catch-all phrase Chinese migrants or migrants ethnic communities should be teased out even more. And these complexities include one's class, gender and ethnicity, so on and so forth.
Thank you very much to all of you. It's been a really terrific and insightful conversation. I've learned a lot, and hopefully people listening will have very much enjoyed your contributions. Great to be sort of stepping back from I guess the daily events of politics and talking about some of these really important underlying factors in our community and our political system. So thank you very much to Sukhmani Khurana, Fan Yang, and of course to Dr. Maria Teflaga, who is with me each week. That's Democracy Sausage again for this week, and we look forward to talking to you again next week. Bye for now.
Bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.